right, party leader Naftali Bennett says he will form a coalition with opposition leader Yair Lapid to unseat Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Danish and European media report that the US spied on top politicians in Europe, including German Chancellor Angela Merkel from 2012 to 2014. Also ahead, South Africa extends its nightly curfew and limits the number of people at gatherings to slow the spread of COVID-19. Welcome to World News from the reigning capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, Israel's far-right party leader Naftali Bennett says he will form a coalition with opposition leader Yair Lapid to unseat incumbent Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Under a prospective power-sharing deal, Bennett will serve as Prime Minister for 2 years before being replaced by Lapid for the second half of the term. Lapid's centrist party, Yesh Atid, came second to Netanyahu's right-wing Likud in general elections in March. Lapid now faces a Wednesday deadline from Israel's president to announce the formation of a cabinet. Netanyahu says a Bennett-Lapid coalition would be a danger for the regime. Israel has held 4 inconclusive votes in the past 2 years. Americans have amassed in the nation's capital to insist that the Biden administration's words be translated into action. Dwight Reed has more from Washington.
We don't ask for permission to free Palestine. We demand it.
The tsunami of voices rising across the globe in condemnation of Israeli war crimes continued to be heard as Palestinians and their supporters thronged the streets of D.C. Steady rain showers weren't enough to dampen the spirits of demonstrators who came from all over the U.S. and descended on the National Mall by the busload.
Came out here from San Francisco. This is how serious it is. We need sanctions for sure, 100% on Israel, because what are we, like, are we their dogs? We don't have to pay them nothing. We don't owe them nothing. All you guys are doing is paying to get kids bombed in Gaza. And this is not right. We don't support no genocide at the end of the day. Like, this is not right.
The protesters called on Israel to stop killing Palestinians and condemned it for adopting what they called apartheid policies. They also called for an end to Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories and demanded that the U.S. government stop funding the regime.
For the thousands gathered out here outside the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. for the National March for Palestine, it's simply not enough that the U.S. government end support for the Israelis. They want them to go a step further and introduce measures to sanction the illegitimate apartheid regime.
Protesters also demanded the U.S. government cease its campaign of harassment and allow lawyers with the International Criminal Court to carry out their investigations of Israeli war crimes unobstructed. They also called for an end to the impunity granted to the apartheid regime by major Western powers.
No country in the world was in violation of international law more than Israel. All of us have to change this. All of us have to tell the administration it is about time to remove Israel from Gaza and from Palestine.
Other speakers rejected attempts by corporate media to use the manufactured anti-Semitism crisis to undermine public support for the Palestinian cause.
The people of the Gaza Strip have the right not just to survive, they have the right to resist, just as Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto did.
Regardless of whether or not the Biden administration bends to the will of demonstrators, those battling for Palestinian liberation here in D.C. seem just as ready to resist Israeli aggression as their brothers and sisters in occupied Palestine. Wyatt Reed, Washington.
Now, a new report shows the United States, with the help of Danish intelligence, spied on top European politicians from 2012 to 2014. A team of European media revealed that the espionage campaign was led by U.S. National Security Agency, which targeted politicians from Germany, Sweden, Norway, and France. German Chancellor Angela Merkel was among those targeted. Denmark's defense minister, who was informed of the spying in August 2020, said systematic eavesdropping of close allies is unacceptable. The report shows that Washington continued to spy on its allies even after the 2013 Snowden affair, Back then, US intelligence contractor Edward Snowden revealed that the US government was spying on its own citizens and its allies. Two people have been killed and more than 20 injured in yet another mass shooting in the US. The shooting took place outside the billiards club in the city of Miami early Sunday morning. Police say a gang of three shot indiscriminately into a crowd and fled the scene. No one has been arrested so far. The US has a long history of deadly gun violence, with schools, workplaces and shopping centers being frequently targeted. Last year, nearly 20,000 gun-related deaths were recorded there. That's more than any other year in at least two decades. President Joe Biden has described the gun violence in his country as an epidemic and an international embarrassment. Elsewhere, the remains of more than 200 indigenous children have been discovered at the site of a former residential school in Canada. Some of the children were as young as 3 years old. The discovery has opened old wounds for indigenous people across Canada and is yet another instance of the country's historical anti-indigenous campaign.
A mass grave containing the remains of 215 indigenous children has been discovered in Canada. The remains were unearthed at the site of a former residential school for indigenous children near the town of Kamloops in British Columbia. The bodies belonged to students, including some as young as 3 years old. The authorities said an investigation into the timing and cause of their death is underway. The Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, reacted to the news by calling it distressing and a reminder of a dark chapter in Canada's history. Also, Canada's National Centre for Truth and Reconciliation said in a statement that the discovery of bodies of Indigenous children at a former residential school is a reminder of the violence that had been inflicted on Indigenous societies. The Kamloops Indian Residential School was the largest in Canada's residential school system. It was part of a network of schools run by the Roman Catholic Church from the 1870s until 1996. For more than a century, Canadian authorities forcibly assimilated Indigenous children by separating them from their families and forbidding them from speaking their native languages or performing cultural practices. Residential schools' main objective was assimilating the children into white Canadian society by severing their Indigenous family and cultural ties. These were the values that colonial settlers, who made up the majority of the population at that time, brought to Canada. Children were victims of widespread physical, emotional, and sexual abuses within these institutions. Today, those experiences are blamed for a high incidence of poverty, alcoholism, and domestic violence, as well as high suicide rates in their community.
The land that is stolen from them is simply a result. It's not the cause. It is certainly part and parcel of it. The indigenous population has suffered greatly since the first white Europeans colonists came to Canada. They stole the land, but they oppressed the people. They killed them. They enslaved them. This is a long, long history of settler colonialism that Canada has not yet come completely to terms with, and it needs to.
At least 150,000 children attended residential schools in Canada. In 2015, a historic National Truth and Reconciliation Commission described it as a culture of genocide targeting the country's indigenous people. However, while these schools no longer exist today, it is a stark reminder of how these children were treated for decades. Many had been taken away from their families for no other reason than the color of their skin.
...150,000 Native or First Nations children were forcibly removed from their families and sent to residential schools. Schools were rife with physical abuse, rape, malnutrition, and other atrocities against the children. A 2015 investigation into Canada's residential school network concluded that the Canadian government and churches have pursued a policy of cultural genocide against the country's rightful owners. The documents revealed that many students civilians lost their lives because they were exposed to outbreaks of measles, tuberculosis, influenza, and other contagious diseases. Over 4,100 children died due to diseases or in accidents at schools have been identified to date. They were often buried in unmarked graves without identification or notice to their parents. Moreover, while the residential schools may be closed, indigenous children continue to be separated from their families in disproportionate numbers. According to census data, in 2016, more than 52% of children in foster care were indigenous. That's while indigenous children made up 7.7% of Canada's all foster children in care population. The systematic discrimination against Indigenous people in Canada has existed for decades. Despite making up just 5% of Canada's population, 30% of the country's prisoners are Indigenous. Also, the government has willfully and recklessly discriminated against Indigenous children living on reserves by failing to provide funding for child and family services.
Yes, their rights will be respected, but will be because of activists, people within the Native community who are working very hard now. There are many, many people who are working for the rights of Indigenous people, people not only members of that community, but members of other communities within Canada. They're working hard to implement government changes, to make the government see that it must respect their rights.
Forced removal, genocide, and assimilation are what colonial settlers inflicted on the Indigenous peoples in Canada. After all, what's for sure is that Canada's foundation as a country is based upon the process of colonization.
Turning elsewhere now, South Africa reimposes stricter measures against COVID-19 as the country braces for a third wave of the pandemic.
Further restrictions are necessary to ensure that health facilities are not overwhelmed and that lives that could be saved are not lost. Delaying the spread of the virus is especially important now to allow as many people as possible to be vaccinated before the third wave reaches its peak.
Ramaphosa says nightly curfews will be extended and the number of people at gatherings will be limited in an attempt to slow the spread of the coronavirus. The level 2 lockdown restrictions will start on Monday, forcing non-essential establishments to close by 8 p.m. and the curfew will start from midnight until 4 a.m. This comes as just over 1% of the population has been vaccinated so far and the campaign to inoculate elderly people started just last week. COVID-19 has so far claimed more than 56,000 lives out of over 1.6 million confirmed cases. The daily tally of coronavirus infections in India has hit a record low in the past 1.5 months. The country reported over 165,000 cases in the past 24 hours. The total caseload now stands at 27.9 million. Meanwhile, there were more than 3,400 new deaths from coronavirus, bringing the overall fatalities to nearly 326,000. India is second only to the United States in terms of the number of infections. The spike is attributed to the spread of an aggressive new wave of the virus in the South Asian country in the past weeks. The World Health Organization says the Indian coronavirus variant has now been detected in more than 53 countries in the world. And Iran has reported 198 COVID-19 fatalities in 24 hours as the overall death toll in the country reaches almost 80,000. The Iranian Health Ministry reported more than 9,000 new infections, bringing the total cases to over 2.9 million. Iran's number of infections has risen in the past months during what is termed as the fourth wave of the pandemic. Authorities say the country has now weathered the latest uptick of the fast-spreading disease. Iran has also administered more than 4 million COVID-19 vaccines so far. The vaccine rollout is expected to accelerate during the next months with the introduction of homegrown vaccines. So, Iran has produced 1 million doses of its first domestically produced COVID-19 vaccine, which is said to be prepared for emergency use, pending approval from the health ministry. Saman Kujuri reports.
COVID-1 Barakat vaccine developers say 1 million doses of the country's first homegrown vaccine have been produced, which will be delivered to the Ministry of Health. Speaking at the press conference, the managing director of COVID-1 Barakat Vaccine Research Group, Hassan Jalili, said production of the vaccine will increase to 3 million doses next month.
We have produced 1 million doses of COVID-1 Barakat vaccine and will be delivered to the health ministry, and its production will increase to 3 million doses next month. And with the launch of new production lines, the figure will increase to 18 million doses soon. Public vaccination with COVID-19 Barakat is going to start in mid-June after clinical results are confirmed by the Ministry of Health.
Officials in charge of developing COVID-19 Barakat vaccine said with the third phase of human trial of the vaccine being almost finished, the result shows Iran's vaccine has effectiveness much higher than expectations and is ready for emergency use after being approved by the health ministry. COVID-1 Barakat was unveiled on December 29, 2020 and started to be mass-produced on March 29. Iran is among the first countries which started developing a vaccine against coronavirus, and now four companies are endeavoring to release their products by September and inoculate the whole population. The second Iranian coronavirus vaccine, RaziCovPars, which started the clinical trial on February 27, will be mass-produced in early August. Iran is also currently producing vaccines jointly with three countries of Cuba, Russia, and Australia. Iran started mass vaccination against COVID-19 with a Russian-made Sputnik V vaccine on February 9. Iran says it will soon become one of the world's important manufacturers of the COVID-19 vaccine. COVID-1 Barakat vaccine developers are planning to get the approval of the World Health Organization for this Iranian vaccine so as to be listed as one of the safest vaccines for emergency use. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
That brings an end to our news bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The Biden administration has reportedly granted Boeing an export license for the sale of $735 million in advanced weaponry to the Israeli regime, news that came as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has recently pledged $5.5 million in emergency aid to help Gaza recover from the latest Israeli regime bombing campaign. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Appalling, Biden's State Department quietly grants Boeing an export license for $735 million bomb sale to Israeli regime. Here's more. The Biden administration has reportedly granted Boeing an export license for the sale of $735 million in advanced weaponry to the Israeli regime, news that came as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken recently pledged $5.5 million in emergency aid to help Gaza recover from the latest Zionist regime bombing campaign. Citing an unnamed congressional staffer, Alex Kane of Jewish Currents, reported recently that the U.S. State Department approved the export license on May 21st, a necessary step in the planned delivery of joint direct attack munitions and small diameter bombs to the Zionist regime. As Kane pointed out, the two kinds of laser-guided munitions were reportedly used by the Israeli regime in the 11-day attack on Gaza Strip that ended recently. The Biden administration notified Congress of the proposed $735 million sale in early May, just days before the Israeli regime launched its latest onslaught against Gaza. The nearly two-week aerial and artillery campaign, which Biden administration officials and the president himself publicly defended, killed more than 240 Palestinians, displaced tens of thousands and further decimated Gaza's critical civilian infrastructure. Warning that selling additional weapons to the Israeli regime would deepen U.S. complicity in war crimes, a small coalition of progressive lawmakers recently mounted a late bid to block the agreement with so-called resolutions of disapproval. But neither the House nor Senate resolution led by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Bernie Sanders respectively has received a vote as the Biden administration plows ahead with the sale. The lawmakers say Congress still has a chance to stop the deal before the weapons are delivered. Jewish Currents reported recently that after being notified for the export license, Sanders responded by placing a hold on all State Department nominees, blocking Congress from considering them for diplomatic posts. After the administration committed to humanitarian aid for the rebuilding of Gaza, Sanders lifted the hold, according to Jewish Currents. Raed Gerar, advocacy director of human rights group Democracy for the Arab World Now, said in a statement recently that the State Department's secretive approval of the export license is all you need to know about its apparent anxiety at proceeding with this troubling deal while Israeli war crimes and apartheid rule continue unabated. Rather than secretly approving arms sales to Israel ahead of his meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, Gerar added, Secretary Blinken should do his due diligence and travel across Gaza to see exactly what kind of harm and destruction American weapons are causing Palestinians. After his meeting with Netanyahu in Al-Quds recently, Blinken visited the occupied West Bank and vowed that the U.S. will provide $5.5 million in immediate disaster assistance for Gaza and a little over $32 million for the UN Relief and Works Agency's emergency humanitarian appeal. In remarks to the press alongside Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, Blinken said the U.S. is committed to helping realize the aspirations of the Palestinian people, which are like those of people everywhere, to live in freedom, to have their basic rights respected, including the right to choose their own leaders, to live in security, to have equal access to opportunity for themselves, for their children, to be treated with dignity, unquote. But human rights advocates and progressive members of Congress have stressed that selling weapons to the Zionist regime currently occupying and brutalizing the Palestinian people is at odds with any serious effort to secure lasting peace and justice in the region. The State Department should immediately revoke approval for this arms sales to, at minimum, allow for proper debate in Congress, Representative Rashida Tlaib told Jewish Currents. Remember that these are weapons of war and destruction that will be used to kill children, bomb hospitals, homes, and schools. Lives literally hang in balance, she added.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. The program is Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss the issues that are raised during the upbringing of our children, who are the future of our community. And to help us with our questions, we have Sheikh Masumi. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh Masumi, thank you very much for being with us.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. So we started an interesting discussion last episode, last time we met each other, and it was about how youth have a very soft heart, which came to a surprise to me, since I used to be a youth back in the old days.
Yeah, definitely, and we were unaware of our this beautiful quality.
Yeah, exactly. And so you distinguish very, very nicely that it's one thing to be soft-hearted, but it's another thing to be obedient. And we say that teenagers are soft-hearted, but we're not saying that they're obedient. Soft-hearted means that they're sensitive and they are ready to accept what's correct. But we ended last episode by saying that parents sometimes don't understand how to treat their teenagers, and that's where a lot of the conflicts arise. That's why they're always fighting with their kids, with their teenagers. And so let's dedicate this episode to giving advice to the parents out there about how they should address and face and help their teenagers.
Yeah, it is a very important question. I think we have spoken about this in our some previous episodes, so just a little bit, I will give you a few points. We have discussed so many rules that how to treat our teenagers. especially with all these sensitivity and with all their this disobediency. So we spoke that there is one rule, asle taghaful, and taghaful means to ignore. Yeah, we have spoken a lot about this.
You haven't
listened to them, you haven't understood what they are doing. And another rule is to respect, you know, respect your teenagers. Although they may be, you know, disobedient towards you, they don't listen to you, but still always be respectful towards them. Because respecting them, you know, it leads them to be respectful towards you, you know. And there are some other rules also that how we can respect them, how we can, and one other important rule is to be a good listener. If you are a good listener to your teenager, then definitely it will help him to be obedient towards you. So likewise, these few rules, if you carefully act upon these rules and apply them in your daily life, then definitely they will become obedient too with you. But it takes time and gradually and slowly.
So we said that first to ignore some of the mistakes that they make. And what is the threshold? There's obviously a line where we won't ignore anymore after that. Where is that threshold?
Definitely, you know, it depends how much your teenager has done mistakes and how many times, you know. Usually we speak about, you know, in general, if your teenager does any mistake in front of you, don't, you know, catch him on the spot and say, you have done this mistake, why did you this? You know, you don't become angry and upset. Because becoming angry and upset at the moment, you know, at that moment, it will give bad consequences.
We'll put them in the defensive.
Yeah. So if you ignore them and let them know that you have understood by some, you know, somehow, then it helps them that he understands that you have understood this mistake I have done, but still you didn't do anything, you ignore me. This gives them, you know, confidence, and slowly they can share with their problems with you.
Thanks. Let's take a break now, and then we'll be back after the break to further this discussion.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are talking with Sheikh Masumi on the soft-heartedness of teenagers. So, Sheikh Masumi, when we're talking about the soft-heartedness of teenagers, you said that we have to help them utilize that soft heart. How can we do that as they're grown-ups?
Before I answer to your question, let me share with you that if they have a soft heart, what is the benefit of having a soft heart? So briefly, let me tell you that if someone has a soft heart, then it's easy for others to guide them, or for himself it is easy to get the guidance. You know, if you have a very soft base, you know, ready base, then you can easily get the guidance. And another benefit is if you are a soft-hearted person, then you easily forgive others' mistakes. Yeah, this is the second quality. And the third quality is if you have a soft heart, so you always look for the righteous, look for the right thing, you know. These are some qualities which our teenagers have. So now it is parents' duty to utilize in such a way that they keep their this softness, soft heart.
So let's start from the top. They're ready to accept the truth.
Right.
How should parents present this truth?
There are a lot of ways how to interact with your teenagers that they keep this soft heart, and according to this they obey and they utilize in their life. So according to ahadith of Aima Ahlul Bayt alayhim assalam, they always said to parents that teenagers' age is a very sensitive, and we have to treat them keeping in mind this soft heart and this, you know, sensitivity. We should keep always in our mind that they are very sensitive, they are soft-hearted. Being this, they are a little bit disobedient also. If we keep this in our mind and treat them and behave with them, then definitely we can provide them their good guidelines.
Can you give us a practical example? How would you do that with your own son?
For example, you know, nowadays because of social media, our kids are very too much indulged with these social media and internet and playing games. For example, I have three sons. You know, my bigger son is 16, 17 years old. So he usually plays games because of this pandemic, corona situation. You know, unfortunately, most of these students, parents, they have the same issue.
You're going to have a tough time convincing them not to
play. Yeah, convincing them. So, for example, if I go straight to them and say to them that this, you are wasting your time, you are, you know, harming your eyes, your mind, and you are wasting a lot of money on these meaningless things,
it's going to create resistance.
He cannot understand that this is meaningless, this is not beneficial for him, this is wasting of time. No. For this, you have to use some
tricks.
Rules and tricks. Yeah.
Let's keep you right there so that we can take a short break just before we reveal those tricks. If you want to hear about them, stay tuned. We'll be back very soon.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are with Sheikh Masumi, and we're talking about the soft-heartedness of teenagers, actually. So the first element, we said, the first consequence of soft-heartedness is that they are ready to accept the truth, but they're a little bit resistant to it. And we asked for a practical example where you said, oh, your own son is 16 and is playing with his mobile phone a lot because of the pandemic. But it's not going to work if you go straight to him and tell him that you're harming your eyes, you're wasting your life. It's going to create resistance. What do you do?
As we have spoken in our previous some episodes, that these do's and don'ts, usually parents use a lot. Yeah, do this, don't do this. They have a long list of these do's and don'ts. They always argue about this with their teenagers, which harms, you know, their relationship between parent and their teenagers. So according to riwayat and according to Islamic teachings, there are very, very useful and golden rules. If you learn them and utilize them in your life, then you will not feel that he is contradicting with you, he is disputing with you, and he is arguing with you.
So we have about 2 minutes. Can you list these rules for us?
So, as I said, if you respect him since the child is, the foremost, the very important rule is respect. Respect and respect. So, if, for example, you have a son from age zero, you started respecting him 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, till 11, 12, then this relation of respecting, you respecting him and he's respecting you, this becomes very, very strong. You know, it shows result after 14, 15 years. This is one of the rules. Okay. The another rule is you become friend with your son or daughter. If you're a mother or father, you become friend and you behave them very friendly. For example, if your son is, you know, interested in games, you also take some time and play some games with him, the games he plays. You also sit with him, discuss with him. This builds the friendship between you and your son. Likewise, listening also, if you listen carefully, whatever he says, definitely in future, this will give him a chance to listen to you. So like this, we have a lot of other rules. If you apply these rules in your life, then definitely it will work with your teenagers.
Okay, thank you very much for sharing some of those rules with us. So I guess it all boils down to respect one way or another. If you missed the program, don't worry. You can always download an archive from our website. Simply visit parstoday.com, click on Call of Islam Radio, and you'll find us right there, Islamic Upbringing. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and Telegram as well. Simply search Call of Islam Radio, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. That's englishradio@irib.ir. Until next program, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Texas lawmakers on Saturday, 29th of May, finished drafting a bill that would impose a raft of new voting restrictions, setting up the likely passage of what would be among the most far-reaching laws in Republicans' nationwide drive to overhaul election systems and limit voting. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Nick Corazzaniti. The piece is titled, Texas Republicans Finalize One of the Nation's Strictest Voting Bills. Texas lawmakers on Saturday, 29th of May, finished drafting a bill that would impose a raft of new voting restrictions, setting up the likely passage of what would be among the most far-reaching laws in Republicans' nationwide drive to overhaul election systems and limit voting. The bill would tighten what are already some of the country's strictest voting laws, and it would specifically target balloting methods that were employed for the first time last year by Harris County, home to Houston. In addition to banning drive-through voting and 24-hour voting, which were used by nearly 140,000 voters in Harris County during the 2020 election, the bill would prohibit election officials from sending absentee ballots to all voters, regardless of whether they had requested them, ban using tents, garages, mobile units, or any temporary structure as a polling location, further limit who could vote absentee, and add new identification requirements for voting by mail. Partisan poll watchers would also have more access and autonomy under the bill's provisions, and election officials could be more harshly punished if they make mistakes or otherwise run afoul of election codes and election laws. The bill, which has hashed out in a closed-door panel of lawmakers over the past week, was rushed to the state Senate floor late on Saturday. In a legislative power play orchestrated by Republican lawmakers and Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, the Senate moved to suspend rules that required a bill to be public for 24 hours before a final vote. The maneuver came just hours after a 112-page report comparing the bill with its previous iterations was delivered to senators, and set debate for the bill to begin at 10 p.m. local time before voting on the bill would unfold. The Texas House did not move to suspend the rules and is likely to vote on the bill on Sunday. Governor Greg Abbott, a Republican who has said that an election overhaul is a priority, is widely expected to sign the bill into law. Texas is one of the several Republican-led states, including Iowa, Georgia, and Florida, that have moved since the 2020 presidential contest to pass new legislation governing elections and restricting voting. The impetus is both Republicans' desire to appease their base, much of which continues to believe that former President Donald Trump's lies about the stolen election, and the party's worries about a changing electorate that could threaten the GOP's longtime grip on power in places like Texas, the second biggest state in the country. Statement on Saturday, 29th of May, President Joe Biden called the proposed Texas law, along with similar measures in Georgia and Florida, an assault on democracy that disproportionately targets black and brown Americans. He called on lawmakers to address the issue by passing Democratic voting bills that are pending in Congress. "It's wrong and un-American," Joe Biden said. "In the 21st century, we should be making it easier, not harder, for every eligible voter to vote." Republican state lawmakers have often cited voters' worries about election fraud, fears stoked by Donald Trump, other Republicans, and the conservative media to justify new voting restrictions, despite the fact that there has been no evidence of widespread fraud in recent American elections. And in their election push, Republicans have powered past the objections of Democrats, voting rights groups, and major corporations. Companies like American Airlines, Dell Technologies, and Microsoft spoke out against the Texas legislation soon after the bill was introduced, but the pressure has been largely ineffective so far. The final 67-page bill, known as SB 7, proved to be an amalgamation of two omnibus voting bills that had worked their way through the state's legislature. It included many of the provisions originally introduced by Republicans, but lawmakers dropped some of the most stringent ones, like a regulation on the allocation of voting machines that would have led to the closure of polling places in communities of color, and a measure that would have permitted partisan poll watchers to record the voting process on video. Still, the bill includes a provision that could make overturning an election easier. Previously, Texas election law had stated that reversing the results of an election because of fraud accusations required proving that illicit votes had actually resulted in a wrongful victory. If the bill passes, the number of fraudulent votes required to do so would simply need to be equal to the winning vote differential. It would not matter for whom the fraudulent votes had been cast. Democrats and voting rights groups were quick to condemn the bill. SB 7 is a ruthless piece of legislation, said Sarah Labowitz, the policy and advocacy director at the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU of Texas. It targets voters of color and voters with disabilities in a state that's already the most difficult place to vote in the country. But Republicans celebrated the proposed law and bristled at the criticism from Joe Biden and others. As the White House and National Democrats work together to minimize election integrity, the Texas legislature continues to fight for accessible and secure elections, State Senator Brian Hughes, one of the bill's sponsors, said in a statement. In Texas, we do not bend to headlines, corporate virtue signaling, or suppression of election integrity, even if it comes from the President of the United States, Brian Hughes added. The bill took its final form after a contentious months-long debate that included a session that lasted until 4:30 a.m., backroom negotiations, procedural errors by legislators, an extended passionate debate by Democrats who had tried to stall the bill's passage through the political and legislative maneuvers. Voting rights groups have long pointed to Texas as one of the hardest states in the country for voters to cast their ballots. One recent study by Northern Illinois University ranked Texas last in an index measuring the difficulty of voting. The report cited a host of factors, including Texas's in-person voter registration deadline 30 days before Election Day, a drastic reduction of polling stations in some parts of the state, strict voter identification laws, a limited and onerous absentee voting process, and a lack of early voting options. In the preamble to the new bill, the authors appear to preemptively defend the legislation from criticism by Democrats and voting rights groups, stating that reforms to the election laws of this state made by this act are not intended to impair the right of free suffrage guaranteed to the people of Texas by the United States and Texas constitutions, but are enacted solely to prevent fraud in the electoral process and ensure that all legally cast ballots are counted. In March, Keith Ingram, the director of the elections in the Texas Secretary of State's office, testified that last year's election in the state had been smooth and secure. Keith Ingram added, "Texans can be justifiably proud of the hard work and creativity shown by local county election officials. A day before the Texas bill emerged, a new report pointed to the vast sweep of Republicans' nationwide effort to restrict voting in America. As of May 14th, lawmakers had passed 22 new laws in 14 states to make the process of voting more difficult, according to a report by the Brennan Center for Justice, a research institute. In last year's election, while Republicans won Texas easily, Donald Trump carried the state by more than 630,000 votes, and the party maintained control of both chambers of the legislature. Turnout soared in cities and densely populated suburbs, which are growing increasingly Democratic. In Harris County, one of the biggest counties in the country, turnout jumped by nearly 10%. Republicans' initial version of the bill put those densely populated counties squarely in the crosshairs, seeking to ban measures put in place during the 2020 election that helped turnout hit record numbers in Texas. The initial bill banned drive-through voting, a new method used by 127,000 voters in Harris County, as well as 24-hour voting, which was held for a single day in the county and was used by roughly 10,000 voters. While those provisions were left out of an earlier version of the bill as it made its way through the legislature, they were reinstated in the final version of the bill. Though the bill does allow for nearly voting to begin as early as 6 a.m. and stay open as late as 9 p.m. on weekdays, it also maintains at least two weekend days of early voting.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.